Welcome to the birth of Fringe Average Mark II. I don't even know.
The new originals.
You're a naughty one, Saucy Jack. You're a haughty one. It's Jason and Mike, and we're back. And I guess this is going to be, what, every couple weeks we'll do this.
Maybe.
As long as we can. So until they pull the plug on us. So we are back, and it is good to be back. I'm just glad to be back talking baseball with you in front of a microphone as opposed to on the phone or via text message.
Right. You know, yeah, I like this form a lot better. It's more intimate, and we get to share it with everybody else.
No, it's really nice that way. So
it is nice.
And we do appreciate everybody who has reached out to us to wonder where the podcast is and when the hell it's starting up again. Because, you know, people love free entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, I know I do. Well, part of the reason, I mean, look, here's the thing. Is that the off season, at least for me, speaking specifically to me, is busier than the regular season. The second the season ends, I go right into, you know, prospect rankings. We brought in a new series. I'm trying to replace staff members. It's been really hectic, and I know you know that you had the AFL. We had a lot of logistics to overcome. So I mean, it's not like it was pure slack as people would like to suggest. I mean, I've actually been busier than I've ever been.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, October is playoffs, and so I'm on the road for a good chunk of it. And you mentioned I was at the AFL, plus it's also vacation time for me generally. So, you know, right around Thanksgiving, Erica and I went to Ireland for a couple of days. And so,
how was that?
Actually, it was really cool. We did Northern Ireland. One of her friends, you'll like this, one of her friends from high school went to grad school in Scotland and met a man and stayed there. And they live in a little town called Ballymena, which is in Northern Ireland. It's maybe like 45 minutes from Belfast.
Okay.
His family runs a garden center there. So that's what they do, is they basically, like, they have their own, like, plot of land that they rent, and they do this garden center and raise chickens, and the whole thing is really cool. It's a lot of fun. They're really, really great people. So they took us around. We went to Belfast for a day, and then we went up to the Giant's Causeway, which is incredible, and then spent a day in Dublin, too, drinking Guinness. So you know, it was fun. It was a great trip. I mean, it was too bad it was only 5 days, but it was a lot of fun.
That's excellent, man. Never been. I'd like to.
Yeah, it's worth it. I mean, it's worth going if you can go. I mean, it was great. We had a tour guide, basically. So, you know, we had somebody who knew what was going on everywhere we went. So it was a lot of fun. But now we're through the winter meetings, and you know, I missed you.
I missed you too.
I missed your face. It wasn't the same. There weren't as many fun people to get drunk with since you weren't there.
Yeah, I know. As I was telling you off air, I mean, like, since I've been working on with all the book deadlines for both the BP annual, and I'm trying to get all the prospect stuff done ahead of time for the prospect book, and, you know, I'm almost through the American League with the prospect list. I haven't had a lot of time for my own, like, own drinking, like, just independent drinking, much less group drinking.
Right. Well, hopefully, I mean, so you're almost done with the American League, so you should be done with the National League by what, like, middle of January?
I mean, middle of January may be a little aggressive, but I mean, at least we hope to have the prospect book out in that dead period after football and before baseball, when there's just jack shit going on. I mean, except for basketball, of course, but who cares? Right. And, you know, to put out the prospect book then, I have to have the BP 101 and all the prospect capsules finished in a couple of weeks for the BP annual that comes out around that same time. So I have to work ahead, and that's a bit of a hassle because it's, you know, I'm trying to rank players that I have in systems that I haven't even really gotten into yet. I mean, obviously I have a cursory understanding of those systems, but, you know, it's much easier when you break down, you know, all applicable players in a system, and then you have a really good idea of, like, not only, you know, their potential, but the, you know, the realistic role that they're going to fall into and the risk factor. So you can start to weigh them. Like, the American League players were a lot easier for me to compartmentalize, but the National League players are still abstract because I haven't really broken them down in their individual tiers yet. But, you know, so that's been a challenge. And as I said, I'm doing it sober, so it's been a real challenge.
So now, how do you do the tiers? Do you put, like, elite level and then just kind of, you know, like, next level, do you use, like, three tiers to break it down? How do you kind of distribute them through that?
Well, for the 101 list, I do kind of come up with three tiers. I think that there's the top tier. There's the top 25 guys. And we've had a really strong debate internally about that. I put out a list of like 30, 35 guys and was like, okay, let's, you know, who do you want? And a lot of the times at that point, you have to weigh their prospect status. Now that gets forgotten a lot, you know, prospect status, like, because if a player reaches AAA, they lose a little bit of that shine. They're still, you know, they're still really good players. They still have a chance to become impact players at the major league level. But maybe, like, for example, a guy like Jackie Bradley Jr., mm-hmm. you know, he's still prospect eligible, you know, and here's a guy that I think is a top 25 guy in baseball, but he lost a lot of shine because he didn't perform well at the major league level. Right.
Right.
And so, but, you know, he's an up and coming guy. And then there's like George Springer, who had an incredible minor league season, you know, didn't reach the majors, but an incredible minor league season. He had a lot of helium. But then you have to look at those two guys in two different systems, two different players, and say, which one do you want? Which one would you rank higher? Which guy would go in the top 25? You know, and so that's the kind of fun debates that we've been having. Or even guys like who are a bit more abstract, like we're gonna really pump Lucas Giolito.
Yeah.
You know, he's gonna be just outside the top 10 in baseball. And so those debates are fun. And then, you know, it gets kind of muddy. I think 26 through 50, those guys have legitimate cases. But then like 51 through 101, man, I mean, you can make a legitimate case for those guys to be, you know, 30 spots higher than they are. I mean, you take a guy in the 70s and say he could be 50 or 100. I mean, I'm not going to really make a case for it. I mean, I'm just going to try to do my best. But, I mean, it's really subjective at that point. I think the top 25 talents in baseball are a little bit more refined. But, man, after you get set past a certain point, it's just kind of who do you like?
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting because I know you don't generally try and set stuff up like it's a pref list, but it sounds like when you get from like 50 on down, you've got to.
Yeah, I mean, if I worked for a team or if this was about me acquiring players, yeah, I'd probably do more of a pref list. But once it gets to 50 to 100 on this type of list, it's like, man. And in fact, before Davidson was traded just a few minutes ago, he was on the consideration list for the top 101. And I was like, man, I don't really like Davidson that much. I'd rather have Colton Wong or, you know, guys like who have a similar, you know, ceiling, roll five type of players. And you know, I was thinking our Scope, you know, Jonathan Scope, I would rather have him. So I was just like, guys, it becomes a pref list after a while. You're right.
Yeah. Let's touch on the Davidson deal because I actually think what the White Sox have done over the last 6 months is really interesting.
Well, I love the Eaton deal, first of all.
Oh, man. I mean, that was a guy that was the preseason favorite for Rookie of the Year in the National League last year, and a year later they're willing to move him. I mean, I understand AJ Pollock kind of settled down the center field situation, but didn't you, I mean, if you're Arizona internally, didn't you put a higher ceiling on what Eaton could be than what Pollock is?
I think that you have to do that, but I mean, I've really questioned some of their moves as an organization the last couple of years. Not that this happens to, you know, not that they're all the same, but when it comes to internal scouting, I was never a big Pollock guy, and in all fairness, and I actually had an email exchange with Rick Hahn about this after the deal went down, just saying, man, you know what? I was always too low on Eaton. I always considered Eaton, and I've written this before, I always thought Eaton is going to be a better major league player than he was a minor league prospect. Hmm. You know, he's one of those guys that's like at the back half of a top 100, but I guarantee he becomes a top, you know, 100 type of player if he can reach his ceiling. I mean, he's a, you know, you can put all the adjectives next to his, you know, his profile with he's a grinder, you know, he's a gamer, he's all that. You know, he can play center. I heard the reports are fine about the injury. You know, I think that it's not going to limit him a great deal. You know, he's a tough out. He's a tough player, and I think that once he gets to play regularly at the major league level, I think he's going to be a really good, solid average to maybe a roll six type of player. And, man, I'd rather have that than Pollock.
Yeah, well, and that was what surprised me on their commitment to him. I mean, obviously, they don't get the deal for Trumbo done without a guy like Eaton, and I know that's you know, I mean, that's the thing is like Trumbo's a really polarizing player, you know.
Seems to be that way.
Nobody likes the fact that he doesn't walk and he strikes out a lot. But man, you watch him take BP.
His BP is very, very impressive. I mean,
it's unbelievable. And it's, you know, he's been a 35-homer bat at the big league level, and there's something to be said for that. And I know he's, you know, listen, what was the league average on base percentage in the American League this year? It was like 320, and I think that's right about where he was. You know, I mean, I don't think he's going to be great in left field. He certainly has a good arm. You know, because they thought of him as a pitcher at one point. I just don't know how to evaluate him because it's I think he can get exposed by really good right-handed pitching, but I don't know how many right-handed hitters, you know, don't get exposed by really good right-handed pitching, but still are able to put up those kind of power numbers. And so it's a really interesting guy. And I have to think, you know, you gotta put Montero between him and Goldschmidt in the lineup. And if you do, then that's, you know, it's not a bad 3-4-5, I guess, in that regard. It's just, you know, the price seems awfully high with him and Skaggs.
No, it does. But, I mean, Skaggs is there's been some problems with that, from the delivery to the velocity being not even being
– Well, you know, he shortened his stride. That was the problem with the deliveries. He shortened his stride in an effort to try and get the changeup more consistent, it sounds like. And as a result, it caused everything else to go backwards. But the changeup got better.
Yeah, I mean, and that's great. I mean, sometimes you have to take a developmental step forward in one thing, or a developmental step back in one thing to take a step forward in the other. Problem is that, you know, he's a big, you know, curveball guy, and you have to be able to throw consistent strikes and get bats moving for those pitches to really be effective. You know, I mean, I soured on him a little bit, but back to the Trumbo point, which is funny, is that, you know, you talk about the contact rates and the fact that maybe he won't walk a whole lot. You know, and that he's not the exact same type of player as, let's say, a Miguel Sano, but at the same time, like, Sano's this really highly regarded prospect who might hit for a low average and really struggle against arm side pitching, but he could still hit 35 bombs, and everybody's ready to, like, say, why this is the next great player. Well, I mean, Trumbo does that now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of value in that. So all the people who are like, oh, you can look past the contact. The strikeouts are okay. It's okay that he doesn't get on base a whole lot. Arnaldo Sano will probably be able to get on base a little bit better, or I'm projecting to be. But, I mean, he still has that sort of right-handed power
right,
that you just don't find that often. And so there's a reason that those guys kind of have value like that. And if you can, you know, actualize and hit 35 home runs at the major league level, hell yeah, you're a big-time player.
Right. And I oversold his on-base percentage. It was .294 this year. But
yeah, that's bad.
.453 slugging percentage, you know. I mean,
yeah, but, I mean, what we
no,
talked
it's not
about
good.
This before. No, it's not good at all, but we talk about this sometimes. I mean, would you like him to be a more complete player? Yeah, but not everybody's an MVP.
Right, right, but he can you know? Be. Yeah, if he had a .330 on-base percentage, he'd be, I mean, he'd be a completely different player. You know,
well,
I mean,
right.
You're talking That's, about a, you know, a 340, 500 guy, yeah.
It depends on roster construction. Not everybody in your team is going to be this balanced, high average, high on base, high slugging type. I mean, you're going to have some sacrifices. And if you can sacrifice somebody getting on base who, you know, somebody who happens to get on base at a higher clip, you know, with less slugging, then maybe you can get by with him being the slugger and not getting on base a whole lot. I mean, there's something to be said about a guy who can hit 35 home runs regardless if he's getting on base a ton.
So my question is, and maybe 35 is unfair with it, but I just kind of want to bring this back to the White Sox, because I think that their last – since July, it's been really interesting for them. You know, they just traded for Matt Davidson. I mean, that was the guy in the organization that had the – I guess in the minors had the biggest power ceiling. I don't think that he was, you know, a 60 power guy necessarily, at least coming up. But does it make sense to trade away all of that to get Mark Trumbo at the big league level when you had Davidson in your system who could have been, you know, potentially, even if he's a second division player? I mean, I think, you know, 25 homers with a low batting average, low on base percentage, does it play that much different than Trumbo does?
Yeah, I guess. I'm not the biggest Davidson fan. I mean, he can play third base. I don't think he's a very good third baseman. I do have questions about his bat. I do not think he's going to be a 30 home run guy. I may be a little low on him. I've always been kind of low on him. You know, to me, he always looked like a first baseman playing third.
Mm-hmm.
I don't love the swing. I don't think he's a complete sellout hitter, but I do think that, you know, once the book is written, I think it's going to be hard for him, especially with arm side stuff. You know, I've always been kind of high on Reed. Now I know that and it's easier to find an Addison Reed than it is to find even a quality major league regular third baseman that can hit for some power, especially when the position's down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand the value that the White Sox are going for. The end result is more value, but right now Reed has, you know, more value. I happen to like Reed. I got to watch him coming up. You know, I loved the fastball. I know that he's had some problems and it's ticked down, which, you know, you kind of, you can raise a red flag. You may be accurate. It may not be, but, you know, I think it's a good long-term move, but I actually like Reed, the player, more. I would take, if you gave me the choice between those two guys to have in my organization, I would take Reed.
Yeah. See, and I may have been with you a year ago, but the velocity dip for Reed was pretty significant. I mean, it was, let's put it this way. It was significant enough at 2 miles an hour on average on his fastball that he threw three times as many sliders as he did the year before.
Yeah.
So he obviously didn't have as much confidence in his fastball at that point as he did with the slider. Now, maybe he can get it back. Maybe it was a one-year thing. But when you were 94, 95, and that's where you're sitting, and now you're sitting 93, I mean, you've lost a foot almost on the fastball. And, you know, from where they're standing, I mean, listen, you just got, what, 5 controllable years of Adam Eaton. You got, what, 6 controllable years of Evasio Garcia, 6 controllable years of Matt Davidson, 6 controllable years of Jose Abreu, who's got a chance to be a motherfucker, and 6 controllable years of Larry Garcia, who may not be an everyday player but is going to play a lot. I mean, that's a pretty significant overhaul of your offensive system, basically, in since July. I mean, I think, you know, overall, I mean, even on paper, I like the idea of trading that 60-inning reliever to be able to get a guy that, even if he's a second-division starter at third base, is a starter, seeing as what they had at third base was an absolute nightmare the last 2 seasons.
Yeah, it's certainly it's going to benefit their organization. I mean, when I look at these type of deals, I often, you know, I get really short-sighted because, I'm used to just analyzing prospects, analyzing players against each other. So I don't often look at what it's going to do for the organization. I look at, like, who would I rather have as a player?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's because I've seen them both a bunch, but when they were coming up, and so that's still ingrained in my head regardless of what's happened at the major league level. And, I mean, I'm still a big Reed fan. I still liked what I saw out of Reed. And I guess I just was never that high on Davidson. He's the type of guy that can definitely prove me wrong. He can prove a lot of people wrong. But, you know, the Diamondbacks have been trying to move him for a while. I mean, I've heard whispers about Davidson being involved in deals for a while now. Now, I don't know if that's accurate. But, you know, and just talking to different sources with different teams and, you know, it's come up in different scouts that you know, Davidson has been available. Well, if he's a fucking stud, why is he available the time?
Yeah, I mean, but I don't think that anybody thinks he's a stud, though. You know what I mean? I mean, I think they think he's a solid player, but I'm not sure that anybody's going to go so far as to think he's a stud. You know?
Okay, well then, if he's a solid player, why are you so intent to move him? Is it because you don't believe
in the strikeouts, and they've already got him with Trumbo,
or they don't believe in the profile, or they don't believe he's going to hit? True.
I mean, and they may see him. I mean, listen, if he's a first baseman in the end, well, the guy that they got ain't going anywhere. You know, I mean, that's the, you know, in Goldschmidt. I mean, you got to move him off there. Now,
yeah, no, that's true.
Now, I mean, when they made the trade for Trumbo, that sealed Davidson's fate. I mean, the big concern was what they were going to do with him. Were they going to put him in left field? Were they going to put him at third base and put Prado in left field? I mean, that was a lot of the discussion that I heard even when I was out in Arizona. In fact, I was talking to – I don't think I'm talking out of school this, but I was talking to Bird about it while we were out there. And he was like, you know, listen, this is a big year. And let's not forget that the GM and the manager are both in the last year of their deals this season. So, you know, as much as we thought of Kevin Towers as always being kind of stable when he was in San Diego, you know, he's kind of – fighting for his job at this point because they had a disappointing 81-81 year. So, you know, I think they're trying to make moves to try and improve this roster now too, but
yes,
we'll have to see whether or not it works. I know they still would really like a starting pitcher.
Well,
that's right at the top of their list. They've been obsessed with Jeff Samardzija. That's why one of the reasons why I was really surprised that Skaggs went in the deal to the Angels to get Trumbo was because they're not going to trade Bradley, and I'm not sure who you get as that next piece.
Get Shipley because, you're not going to.
Yeah,
you're not going to trade a guy who's going to be a player to be named later.
I mean, who's the lefty the out of Kent State? Chafin, right? I mean, that's
he's not going to headline.
He's not
going
to headline anything. No,
right.
And the Cubs need pitching. I mean, if they're moving Samardzija, they're not doing it without getting a pitcher back. So.
Yeah, I mean, I like the way that they're handling it. I like the way that they're being patient. I think that it could benefit them. I mean, there's some teams who aren't being as patient, and you mentioned front office stability. I think that something has occurred, a team that we've spoken about, you know, frequently on the show in previous episodes about stability and what we would do with that organization, and it's the Mariners are really pushing it in. I mean, in.
In.
I mean, you know, they're prison cell pushing it in, if you know what I mean.
You know, that article in the Seattle Times, which if you haven't read it yet, you need to go back and read it from, what was it, last
Sunday? How damaging. I mean, God damn it.
Well, here was the thing, is I talked to somebody who said that what really shocked them in the organization about that article was that there wasn't a single thing. Normally there's an article, you go, oh, okay, well, you got that from a source, but that's not entirely true. The biggest thing was that it was 100% accurate. That was the thing that was most shocking about it, is that he didn't miss, that Jeff Baker, who wrote the article, didn't miss on anything in it. And that is as damning as anything, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, this is, listen, let's connect the dots here, right? There was concern that Jack Cerensik was going to be out of a job after last
years ago.
We talked about years ago. Well, we talked about it. We talked about it over the course of the summer.
We did,
and said, you know what, you know, whether or not, you know, it's, let's see what happens. They've got some nice players that are in their system. Let's see what happens, plays out. At least that was my take on it. What ends up happening is he gets the year extension, and then Chuck Armstrong, the company president, retires. And whether he was retired or asked to retire, whatever it was, it became apparent that Chuck Armstrong wasn't going to lead the search for a new general manager. Well, at the same time, the manager didn't want to get another deal because he was unhappy with his communication with the front office. And so he bounced. And so they ended up having to hire a new manager in this, whereas opposed to having everybody kind of on a one-year deal where it could have been a clean break at the end of next season, now everybody is set up at different times. But the question is going to be, who's going to be the next president of that organization? Because, I mean, and I hope this doesn't sound like it's piling on, but certainly there have been whispers for a while about what's going on there. And there is some concern, I think, you know, over the course of this next season, if in fact that they start winning, that you may have to keep going down this kind of same road. And certainly that's what the front office would like, is they would like to win. They would like to keep their jobs. But I'm not sure that everybody, you know, even in ownership with the Mariners, is comfortable with where they are going forward, despite the fact that they desperately need Robinson Cano because their ticket sales have dropped off, like cut in half over the last decade.
Yeah, I mean,
did that make sense, what I said?
Yeah, it does. I understand the need to go after a marquee player. I understand the need to you know, enhance your major league lineup, but to be competitive, not just to, I mean, obviously saving your job is a nice benefit there, but I mean, you got to field a winning team. That's the whole point here. And, you know, they've built it slowly. They had, you know, got to add major league pieces to the minor league pieces and make it work. It's kind of the cavalier attitude that I think that, or the approach that I think a lot of people have, like, you know, taken a step back on. It's the fact that, you know, Zariznik doesn't really have anybody left that he can, that can, you know, shield him from the inevitable here. And the only way to delay or to, you know, to get rid of that inevitability is to win. So you go out and you get Cano, you start making, you let it be known that just about everybody in your system is available. You know, you go, it seems like it's a big push in, and I, you know, I'm not against a big push in all the way. I mean, I liked it what the Jays did in recent years. I know it didn't work at least initially, but I liked it when they pushed in and put in a lot of their prospects and went for major league quality talent and decided to try to win at the major league level. I liked that approach. I think it's risky, but I think that you gotta try to win at the major league level. You gotta make your mark. The way that Zariznik's gone about doing some of this, though, is that, you know, he's definitely thrown a lot of people under the bus in the industry, and there's a lot of people who have a lot of negative things to say about the approach that they've taken over in the previous few years. And, you know, I think that's kind of the thing, that here's a guy that has he's got a long history in the game, and I think that just the behavior of the recent years has tainted that a little bit.
No, I agree, and I think that there's, you know, the one thing that I've heard is that you know, I mean, it certainly has in the minds of some, is that you know, you're talking about a guy who's been a very well regarded scouting director over the course of his stops because of what he's been able to do well. And it just hasn't, you know, it hasn't translated, and it hasn't necessarily translated in terms of a management style too. And I think that gets lost a lot in, you know, what has to happen in as a general manager is it's not just about player evaluation. You have to manage the people below you. And I think that's the case. You know, we always talk about how important it is for field managers to manage people, right, as opposed to the strategy. But managing people from a front office standpoint is equally as important.
No, I agree.
And it's not to say that that outweighs necessarily. I mean, I think that it's managing people on the egos in the clubhouse might be more important than managing the egos in the front office or the people that you're dealing with in the front office, just from a standpoint of, you know, because you need to get the players, you need to acquire the players first and foremost. But that it is a skill, and it can, you know, it can lead to defections, and that's part of what's happened in Seattle is that there have been a lot of scouts that have left over the last, you know, 4 years.
Yeah, there's that, and there's also, I mean, we kind of talked about this off the air, but and I've been asked this via email recently. It's like from somebody at the Seattle event that BP held, and they're like, you know, it was just like, hey, remember the BP event? I mean, they trotted out, you know, Jack was there obviously, but they trotted out a very large and, you know, able analytics crew. To the BP event, maybe because it's Baseball Prospectus and it was still the reputation that, you know, it's going to be a numbers specific crowd. But anyway, so he brought out all these guys and he gave them a lot of accolade and he let them talk. And there was a lot of really, you know, intelligent discussion about process and, you know, the importance of analytics, the importance of advanced statistical evaluation, blah, blah, blah. You know, but I mean, a lot of these moves seem to have very little hand of analytics in them. You know, it doesn't seem like the guys that they trotted out on that stage have a very important role within the organization. It certainly seems like it's that there's more of a singular bully type of approach. And maybe that's inaccurate, but that's the way it seems, at least from afar.
Yeah, And I mean, I think that's the thing that's most interesting to me is that if you're going to create such a giant analytics department and yet the moves that you make are going to kind of fly in the face of it, then why do you have it? I mean, it's one thing to be the Phillies and be, you know, now, and I'm sure that there are Philly fans that hate the fact that they're so obstinate about the fact that they don't consider the numbers, that they consider themselves a scouting organization and that's all that they care about. But at the same time, they're honest about the fact of where they are. I mean, if you're using the information, you know, at least make moves that make it look like you're using the information. And certainly, you know, the star of that Seattle Times piece, so to speak, was Tony Blangino, who was the guy who was in charge of their analytics. And you and I were talking in Seattle. We knew that he was kind of on the outs there and that he wasn't nearly as much a part of the discussion as to what was going on in Seattle. He was a guy that really kind of helped them to focus on defense you know, 3 or 4 years ago in the free agent market. But, you know, that's the thing is that if you're going to create these you know, giant staffs of people who are doing advanced analytics, you better use them. You know, otherwise you're wasting money. You know, take that money and, you know, put it into an extra middle reliever. I don't know. I mean, it's not that those guys are making that much money. I mean, a lot of them aren't getting paid a whole lot, so.
No, I mean, we both spend time talking to those guys, both before the event or after the event, and man, just some really, really sharp baseball minds that happen to lean more towards the analytics than the scouting, but it certainly seems like a lot of these decisions are being made, you know, top down, my way or the highway type of moves, and obviously that's easy for me to say just from afar because I'm not in the room with these guys.
Well, sure, and your ass isn't on the line, too. You know?
Right. Yeah. I'm not a part of these discussions. I'm just saying it from afar, from, you know, a baseball insider point of view, but not inside baseball. They seem, you know, cavalier and, you know, throwing up, the Hail Mary here.
Mm-hmm. You've been going through the American League systems, as you mentioned before. I'm curious, who is the biggest riser from people that you've talked to? Who's the guy that you didn't expect to kind of be as high on going into it as you are?
Yeah, that's interesting. Let me pull up the teams that I've done so far, just so I'm familiar. Well, let's see. You know what? I'll make it a little broader here. I went in. I've known that the White Sox system has been shit for a long time.
Right.
And I've been, you know, I was an asshole about it a couple of years ago. Like, I wasn't doing full rankings, but when I was like, when Kevin was doing the rankings and I was doing like the, my own little like top five players you want to, you don't want to miss in the systems. Like for the White Sox, all I did was list real genius characters.
Right.
Because the system was so bad, I didn't even want to deal with it. And then in the last couple of years, it's been pretty bad. But man, I tell you what, I like what they did in the draft this year a lot. And I like that they're back in Latin America. I liked the guy that they signed, the Micker Zapata. I liked him. He was my favorite, one of my favorite bats of the prototypical corner bats that I saw in the Dominican in the January showcase. the deeper I went in that system, I mean, I started to really like it. I started to like a lot of the guys that they had drafted. I liked a couple of the players that had taken steps forward, even if they had some statistical regression. I like what they were doing from a player development standpoint. That's a system that, I mean, it's still bad, but it's no longer, you know, putrid.
Right.
And that was a really pleasant surprise. Another one was I went in thinking, hey, you know, I know the Jays have a good system. I'm aware of their players. It wasn't until I started, like, finding guys that I knew that had the Jays organization, you know, and started asking, like, man, who do you guys like in the short season levels? And their short season levels are fucking stacked. I mean, this is a team that got rid of a bunch of high-end top 100 prospects, mm-hmm. you know, with, you know, the Darnot and Syndergaard and all the and the trades down south, losing guys like Mariznick and Nicolino. Man, this system is – it might even be stronger than I had it last year.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, first of all – I had a bunch of sources on Stroman. Man, my guys love Stroman.
Oh, dude, I saw him in the AFL, and my God, that's special. In fact, I talked to Tom Gordon about him. I ran into Flash at the Winter meetings, and you know they get cuffed a lot because they got the big breaking ball, and because they're both 5'9" or whatever, maybe 5'9". And he had seen Stroman on TV, and he was like, "Oh man, he looks like he's incredible." And you know, Tommy obviously started as a starter and then moved to the bullpen. But I'm interested to hear what you guys had to say about whether or not he can stay in the rotation.
Well, I mean, we ranked him number one in that system based on the fact, or based on the theory, that he will be in the rotation, that he does have what it takes to be in the rotation. I talked to guys who scouted him as amateurs. I talked to guys that scouted him, you know, in the minors. You know, I stay away from talking to the org itself about players until after I've already constructed the list, because I don't want to be influenced by them. I don't want any manipulation. But man, consensus was that he's a starter. It's not ideal. It's not prototypical, obviously. But man, he's short, but he's not frail. He's strong, and he's a competitor. In a major fucking way. He's got balls. He's got rig. And he's got the arsenal. Yeah. I mean, he's got the cutter that he started to bring out in the AFL. He's got the big fastball. He's got the slider that he can manipulate. It kind of looks like more of a hard curveball at times because of the two-plane movement instead of just a pure slice. The changeup has got a lot of action to it. Man, and he knows what to do with it.
Right.
And you look at that and you see, you know, a guy who's listed at 5'9", but I think he's smaller. And you say, well, he's a reliever. He's an elite closer, which is awesome. That's an awesome floor to have. And so I looked at it like, okay, man, even if he is a closer, there's very little risk there. I mean, this guy's just going to come in and throw BBs. And Aaron Sanchez, for all the sweet arm action that he has, for all the ceiling, for the fact that he can just throw in the mid-90s like it's nothing, he's not a complete pitcher. Mm-hmm. You know, there's more risk there. I'd definitely take Syndergaard over Sanchez. I think that Sanchez still has that crazy high ceiling. But, man, he's – you know, there weren't good reports on how he goes about with his pitchability, with his ability to repeat, to locate, to attack. Yeah, I kind of soured on it a little bit. I still think he's a top 35 type of prospect in baseball, but man, that decision to go with Stroman feels good now. I felt confident. And then you keep going down that list. You have like Alberto Tirado, who's a really loose arm kid. You have Daniel Norris, who's really taken a step forward and put that bad season behind him. You got high ceiling, like, you know, position players and DJ Davis and Franklin Barreto. You have more arms, you know, there's just arms for days. Hiro Labort is a fucking name and a fucking arm. Big lefty kid with stuff. Man, their system, you keep going lower and lower and lower in those systems and all their short season affiliates, and they're just fucking stacked with high ceiling arms. That organization is fine.
They're the anti-Cubs, right? The Cubs have all the bats and the Jays have all the arms.
Yeah, I mean, and the Cubs still have some arms. I mean, right.
The Jays still have some bats. So,
yeah, they do. I mean, it's just talent. The thing is that they have to mature those arms, and there's so much can happen with lower level pitching. But I like what Norris has. I like what Toronto has. I like Stroman. Still got to like Sanchez. It's not like he's bad or anything. Sean Nolan's a guy who came up and had his asshole ripped apart in that one appearance at the major league level, but he's still a big pitcher with four pitches that he can move around. I mean, he kind of has a pedestrian fastball, but I mean, he's a number four, number five type of starter, and you're not probably low risk. So, damn, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a really good organization. So like in the process, I didn't hear like one player, like, I mean, I got good when we were doing the Twins system, you know, that's another system that their number 11 through 20 prospects is better than the Yankees system as a whole.
Right.
You know, and even guys who are at the back end of that top 10, you know, like the Australian kid, Lewis Thorpe, you know, I got really big reports on him. Felix Jorge, you know, they have a lot of low level arms too, that are in that category of like, get the fuck out of the way. I think that the one pitcher that I got the highest, I mean, I knew he was going to get big reports, but Hunter Harvey.
Yeah.
With the Orioles.
Yeah.
You know, our own Chris Mellon had seen him a couple of times. I think Mort might have seen him. All the reports were like, dude, this guy could be a number two starter. Do not hesitate to blow this guy up. He's got feel. He's got a lot of physical projection left. You know, he knows how to throw the secondary stuff. He knows how to sequence. I mean, it's immature, but it's going to get there. That's a big arm, and people were ready to blow him up.
Yeah. That's a strange system. You know, I mean, I see them at their double A a lot and see some of their A ball stuff just because I'm close by. But I think that's better than what people realize too at the top. I mean, I'm you know me, I love Eduardo Rodriguez. I think he's just going to be a really solid major league starter. But I know there are some people in their organization that really like Mike Wright.
I like Mike Wright.
You know, who's a little bit further down on the list. And I think, you know, I mean, Scope is really the only position player prospect of some, you know, kind of ilk right now, but but those guys, I mean, between them, I mean, they're all guys that profile, you know, kind of mid rotation or better. I mean, maybe Wright's got the lowest ceiling, but I know that they really like him. I just can't believe, I can't wait till people get a chance to see Eduardo Rodriguez this year at Triple. He's gonna be in the big leagues this year.
I think so.
And he's gonna be one of those guys that you just look up at in 6 years, and you know, he's gonna be, you know, maybe 10, 12 games over 500 for his record, and he's gonna have logged, you know, like a 190 innings a year basically over 6 years, and he's gonna get a huge payday. Because he's just gonna be that kind of mid rotation lefty that gets guys. I mean, he's just gonna get guys out. He's a little bit like Wei-Yin Chen, I think, from that.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I think that he's going to be a very good major leaguer. And this is funny because this shocked some people, and I'm not going to say that I agree with it. But in the under 25 list, which Chris Mellon put together, he actually ranked Gausman ahead of Machado.
Yeah, I saw that.
And, you know, that was like, people were like, oh, what the fuck was that? Would you say that? That's ridiculous. And I was like, no, you know, I wouldn't say that, but I'm not so sure that that's ridiculous. And so I started texting with some sources like, hey, did you see the BP thing about the under 25, blah, blah, blah. And people were responding like, yeah, it's ballsy. I may not agree with it, but man, Gausman can be a motherfucker.
Yeah.
Do not sleep on that kid. Not that Machado can't be, but Gausman is a man. That guy could be a man.
Yeah, he really needs two things, and one is better fastball command. That's the first thing that he needs.
Sure.
And he's got to tighten up the breaking ball because he's got two – I mean, he's throwing a splitter and a circle change, and they're both bastard pitches. I mean, and you get fastball – I mean, shit, look what Michael Wacha did with barely a breaking ball, right? You
know,
now, he had really good fastball command. And Gausman, I think you could probably – now, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think from your standpoint, if you're evaluating him, you could go, you know what, he's probably got a more repeatable delivery than Wacha does.
I know he does. I get he's athletic. He's got – I mean, he can show a little bit too much. I think the fastball's a little visible. But the problem is that he often works belt up.
Right.
And that's a problem at the major league level. You can blow guys away in college and all that, but once he learns to really locate the fastball, and then, you know, you're going to be victim to that trapdoor changeup he has. And I know he added the circle change to add a little more fading action mm-hmm. to it. You know, so he's got that one that he can throw at, you know, the drop off the table changeup he throws with a lot of velocity, you know, and an arm speed deception. And then if he can really tighten that slider, and, you know, he was a curveball guy at times too right. in college. And so he really couldn't find that breaking ball that worked, much like Waka was. I mean, Waka never had that consistent breaking ball. Everybody was like, you know, are you going to throw a curve? Are you going to throw a slider? I think that the slider is going to come around for Gausman because when he can stay to the side of it and really pop it, that thing's a monster pitch too. Mm-hmm. It's just not like the changeup. If he can put that together with fastball command, you're looking at a guy with who can hold 95 plus, hold right. it, with two wipeout changeups. And a slider that if he can learn to locate it and at least get it into the corridor, dude, that's a big time player. That's a big time player. And I talked to a lot of people that were like, man, if given the choice, I'd take him over Bundy.
Well, that's I mean, there were some people in the organization that felt that way a year ago, you know, and that was they just loved. I mean, Gausman came in and he started doing the drills in the minor leagues and was just like, I mean, blew everybody's mind. There was there's a drill Rick Peterson has guys do where he sets up like a string to like basically be the bottom of the strike zone, and the goal is to hit the string with your fastball, right? And you have 20 throws, and the first time Gausman did the drill, the story goes he hit it 19 times, and that was one of those things where they were like, oh wow, you know, like we knew he had something good. But we didn't realize it was this. And, you know, I think they had – I mean, I think these stories have all been told, that Alan Dunn, who's the pitching coach at LSU, had been in the Orioles organization for a long time. And so they had a really good kind of feel for who he was. And mm-hmm. I've met Gausman a couple of times. He's a great kid. I mean, really great kid too. So,
yeah,
you really got a pull for him in that. So, but man, with him and Bundy coming off Tommy John, I mean, it's just, you know, and again, it's local. I mean, I don't think that their major league club's nearly as good as the other local team I have here, because Washington's major league team is going to be just a son of a bitch.
It is, man. But give it a couple of years for the Orioles with Machado taking that next mm-hmm. step forward, and you have a rotation that's going to have Bundy and Gausman and Rodriguez and eventually Mike Wright in the back of that. I guarantee Mike Wright's going to be a number 4-5 starter. I mean, it's not going to be sexy, but they're going to have a very cheap rotation, and they're going to have money. And man, the Orioles are not a team to fuck with in the next couple of years.
Well, yeah, the problem is that their fans are antsy right now because they've seen them get close a couple of times, and it's just, you know, they're not spending any money this offseason, and that's a big concern for.
Also, Rodriguez is he's Dominican, I believe, right?
Yes.
Well, they'll have to get rid of Buck.
That's awful. No, he's. I don't think Eduardo Rodriguez is Dominican. I had to say that because I had this. I was trying to think. We had this conversation. He's Venezuelan.
Okay, I thought he was.
Venezuelan. We were talking about this. I was having this conversation with John Manuel before one of the AFL games. We were standing on the field BSing. I've been friends with John for a long time, and we were just talking about the lack of Dominican starting pitchers overall.
Yeah,
and how few
we
of them.
About
yeah,
that
but how few of them? But he said, you know, it's how few of them have a feel for a changeup, and I'd never put that together. And you think about it, it's, you know, Johnny Cueto's got a great changeup, but
Edison Volquez has a great changeup.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he doesn't know where it's going.
No, he doesn't know where he is.
Pittsburgh. That's where he is now. He's in Pittsburgh. But yeah, I mean, I thought that was a really interesting comment, and I was like, yeah, you know what? That's.
Well, I mean, think about
it. It's pretty sharp. I mean, that's
changeup
true.
Is a feel pitch. I mean, it's obvious though. The changeup is a feel pitch, and you don't get signed. You know, you get signed out off the island by throwing gas.
Right.
You know, and those kids don't often learn the nuances of pitching. It's often the deliveries are very rushed. You know, there's not a lot of fluidity in them. The breaking balls are usually hard, of the harder variety. They overthrow a lot. And the nuance required for a changeup, maintaining that arm speed, it takes feel, and it takes a lot of feel. And, you know, you don't often see that with Dominican pitchers. You definitely see it a lot more with Venezuelan pitchers. And part of the reason is that those aren't just solely showcase kids. I mean, there's Venezuelan little leagues. There's travel ball teams. Dominican, they're not as fortunate to have those kind of structured little leagues at a young age. So these kids are just, you know, they're on the fields working out for agents, playing in some showcases, but it's showcases. So they're throwing as hard as they can, trying to impress. There's not a lot of structure. And I think that at its core is one of the reasons that Dominicans lack a lot of feel when it comes to pitching.
That's interesting. It's interesting. And I always wonder too, I mean, it's, you know, it just kind of depends on who you get with. Cause I think of, and now granted he's not a starter, but Joaquin Benoit obviously has a great changeup, and he talks about learning it from, Bob Nipper, and that, you know, that was the Fosh that he always used to teach. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you have to have the right arm slot in order to do that. And Joaquin, you know, obviously has it. So, you know, it's not something that necessarily, you know, translates to every single guy. But, so I always wonder about trying the guys with splitters earlier. You know, if they're getting to the big leagues and they're getting there fast and you know, you're struggling to find a changeup. I know a lot of times it's a field pitch and it comes later and you don't want to rush it. But, man, give them a splitter. Why don't guys use the splitter more? I think I've made that argument before, but
well, especially guys with really big hands. Look at a guy like the Yankees guy, like Rafael DePaula. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a guy that he showed up stateside, you know, missing a ton of bats just on the life of this fastball. He doesn't really know where it's going, but it's a 70 wiggle type of pitch. But you know, he'll flash quality breaking ball. He'll flash the changeup. The problem is that he doesn't really have, you know, a good idea of what either one's doing. I mean, that's a guy with his type of hand size. I would give him the fastball, and I would give him the splitter, and I would say go out there and throw as hard as you fucking can.
Right.
You know, because that's who you're going to be. He is not going to be a starting pitcher. You know, he is going to be a reliever. If he's going to be a reliever, man, quit wasting time in the minors. Get his command going and throw him up there and get him to throw as hard as he fucking can. He's going to be a mid-90s guy with tons of wiggle on the fastball. And he's got the hand strength and the hand size to do something pretty fucked up with a split finger pitch. That's what I would make him.
Have you seen, and we'll wrap with this just because you just posted Yankees today. That organization went from being one that I feel like was like on the verge of right in the top 10 a couple of years ago in terms of organizational depth. I think Kevin had them in the top 10 at one point. To where they are now, and none of it has been for the right reasons. Like they haven't. It's not that they've had defections to the big leagues that have crushed their farm system.
No, they never promote anybody.
Nobody has developed. I mean, injuries or poor performance or whatever. I mean, that's I know it's been a big topic in New York with them, but man, that is really incredible. I mean, that's a lot of shit that has to just go wrong that you can't control. Have a system take that kind of step backwards, isn't there?
I think a lot of it is bad luck, and I'm going to be careful with my words because I know a lot of people in the Yankees organization, and I know that they're smart baseball people. So this is – but it's my job to critique. It's also my job to look at every system in baseball. Man, it's bad. It's a bad system, and I think it obviously starts with talent acquisition. You know, there's a player development angle, obviously, and then there's obviously the luck involved. They have had some bad luck. But, I mean, there's also the way that people go about – analyzing their system. I think the Yankees are better than most teams when it comes to media manipulation. I think that
they used to be. I think that I think guys like you have helped to, you know, kind of end those days of the media manipulation when it comes to systems.
You still
get a much better idea of what's out there publicly now.
No, I know, but I mean, you still get it a lot with the Yankees, and you got it with them trying to tell people that Montero was a good catcher. You're getting some of the same stuff now with Gary Sanchez and how the big improvements that he's made behind the plate, which I couldn't find a source to back up at all. It's those type of things that you read that you're like, you know, that's probably coming from the Yankees organization, and that's fine. It's their job to do that. I couldn't find anybody to substantiate that. I think that what it comes down to is a few years ago, a lot of people overrated the system because, and I could say I was guilty last year of it. You know, after Mason Williams, who I didn't like at the time, and I even said that in the report, but I didn't really have a good feel for Mason Williams. I didn't really like him, but you know what? He put up really good numbers, and he plays a premium position, and you can't ignore that shit. You know, and the thing is, he's got some makeup concerns. It definitely showed up on the field. Mm-hmm. The work ethic was questioned. I think that, you know, Gary Sanchez is – people have been talking about his makeup since he was 15 years old and not in a positive way. I think that that's one of the reasons a lot of sources are sour on his defensive skill set, just because the work ethic to be a dual threat catcher isn't always there. Sometimes it's there. Obviously, the arm strength is there. Sometimes he can look good. But, you know, catching is about consistency. And a lot of people just don't see that coming for him. Slade Heathcott's a guy that, you know, Tom Verducci compared to fucking Josh Hamilton for no reason. You know, yeah, he's a fast guy. He's got a lot of tools, but I mean, he can't stay healthy, and it's hard to see him putting that all together. You know, he could be one of those guys that's just kind of an up and down guy, and then he has one just huge year for no real reason. That I think that they had an interesting draft. I mean, I got to watch Jagielo a lot in the New York Penn League, and I wasn't all that impressed, especially for a polished college power hitter. I thought that he was beat by average stuff. But, I mean, it's a short season ball after a long collegiate season, so it's kind of hard to put too much on him there. They Aaron Judge, who's just a monster human being that they drafted out of Fresno, who's, you know, what, 6'8"? 6'7", 6'8". I mean, just a monster human, monster power. Ian Clarkin's an interesting lefty that they got that that some people, you know, he has Kershaw-like mechanics with the high hands above the head and the high leg, and you know, he doesn't have Kershaw stuff, but it's something to work on. Jose Ramirez is a reliever that can't stay healthy, but I mean, obviously he's a starter, but he's a reliever long term most likely. They have a lot of guys who they profile as like platoon or bench guys or relievers. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of guys in that system that you're like, oh yeah, that guy is a role six player. Tyler Austin's a guy. I mean, he can swing the bat, but he's probably an average at best major leaguer. You know, J.R. Murphy, average at best, probably just a backup. These are the guys who are in their top 10, man.
It's not good.
It's, I mean, there's a lot of lower risk guys. I mean, Mason Williams is probably going to end up being a major leaguer at some level, you know, playing bench outfielder or something. Slade Heathcott is going to be one. Murphy's going to be one. Austin's going to be one. Hell, Greg Bird is probably going to be one. But are any of those guys impact potential guys? I mean, I don't see it at all.
Yeah.
Their lower levels are all right, and I like, you know, I like what they do in the Dominican a lot. I like the guys that they acquire, but, man, they're just not developing those guys.
Right. Yeah. And there were all these rumors that they were going to make changes in their player development and their scouting staff this year, and they didn't. So they're going one more round with the group of guys that they have. And, I mean, like you said, there are a lot of really smart baseball people in that
Hell
organization.
Yeah, big time.
And maybe it is more bad luck than anything else. But, I mean, you know, the thing is that we could view this system completely different. This is the thing I think is really interesting about it, is we could view this system completely differently a year from now if guys are able to stay healthy. You know, Williams had you mentioned the makeup stuff. He had the off-field stuff too. He had the DUI. He had some injuries, all that. You know, Austin obviously had the wrist stuff. You know, all of these things. Heathcott hasn't been healthy for the most part. But if they're able to all put together one healthy season and, you know, play somewhat up to where their potential is right now, gosh, all of a sudden, a year from now, you're looking at the system with the same guys and going, well, now we project these guys to be, you know, everyday major leaguers. Or now, in July, they're able to move those guys to try and sell high to add pieces to their major league roster, which is probably the most likely avenue based on the makeup of their big league team. And that's, I think, one of the more interesting parts of that system is, as bad as it is, there's a big difference between what the ceiling is and what those guys are right now, just because of, you know, because again, like you just said, a lot of that was bad luck.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a difference between this system and like the Angels system. I mean, at least the Yankees guys are just underachievers right now. You know, you could see Mason Williams maybe taking a step forward. You could see, you know, Slade Heathcott staying healthy and showing the potential that he has. You could see guys like, you know, Severino stepping forward and becoming a legit, like, name prospect. A guy like, you know, catcher Luis Torrens stepping up and becoming a prospect. You can see Gary Sanchez, like, the bat coming alive in Double A, and then, like, all this stuff happens. And all of a sudden, the system's like, oh, okay. Shit, you know, Manny Benuelos is going to come back and probably reach the major league level at some point this year. Montgomery could recover from injuries. You could see the system going like, oh, okay, well, this is a much better system. The reason that there's so much fluctuation is because they had so many underachievers this year.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not like the Angels system where there's just nobody to there's nobody to achieve.
Right.
There's no achievement to be had.
With that, what do you got? What's on your plate from now to Christmas?
Man, I am I'm busting ass on. I'm writing the Rays list today. And then I'm doing the Red Sox at the end of the week or beginning of next week. We're writing the prospect capsules for the Baseball Prospectus 101 and the BP Annual. We're putting out hot stove reports this week on guys like Mike Napoli, Santana, Ellsbury, the series that we've been doing.
Yeah, that's some good shit, by the way.
Thanks, man. I really like it. And introducing letting the guys who we brought on to replace Morton Cole start to get their feet wet writing reports and getting out there. And then I got to keep doing the prospect list. I'm going to go to the National League and try to get all that done. So it'll probably pop my head back up in February at the earliest.
Nice.
Yeah.
Way to stay underwater.
Yeah. Thanks. What are you going to be doing?
I've got, just regular work, and then, I actually get a couple of days off. I got to burn vacation days before the end of the year. So, finish that. And then, going to Chicago for Christmas, for just about 48 hours to go see the family. So we go every year. This is the first time in a long time we haven't driven. So, I get to see the, nephew's first Christmas, which will be fun. But other than that, just keep on keeping on.
Excelente.
So, and with that, I guess we're back. So, Merry Christmas.
Let's not do another one.
Ever?
That'd be funny, right?
It'd just be like, hey, we're back, and scene. You know what? You should threaten that at the end of every podcast and be like, you know what? This could be our last one. So, we'll see what happens.
That's a good idea.
Let's not make promises we can't keep. So,
yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, I want
to
be.
We'll talk to you guys again in a couple weeks.
I want
to
be pure. I want to be honest with our listeners. I just want to be pure, Mike.
I know. Purity of your essence, that's for sure. So, all right, Merry Christmas.
All right, bud.
Later.